We'll just pray for Steve before he speaks. And dear Lord, thank you for Steve. Thank you for your word. And thank you for the work that Steve's put into the sermon this morning. Lord, give him heavenly wisdom and give him words from heaven and from straight from you. We ask this now that you'll give us ears to hear and eyes to see what you have to give us this morning. We ask this in your glorious name, Lord. Amen. Thanks,
Glenn. Well, how'd you follow all of that? I'm going to try anyway. So this morning, we're continuing our series that we've been looking at on Advent. We're trying to turn our eyes towards Bethlehem to help us think about what happened all of those years ago and prepare ourselves for Christmas. And to do that this morning, we're going back 600 or 700 years before Jesus was born. That's when the words that we've just read from Isaiah were written. But I wonder, where's the darkest place that you've ever been? I was thinking about that this week, and I came to the conclusion that the darkest place that I've ever been is one of the bedrooms that I had while I was at university in Aberdeen. For a couple of years, I lived in a flat with four other guys, and my room was not much bigger than a cupboard. Think Harry Potter, room under the stairs. You get the sort of picture of how big it was. But it did have this one redeeming feature about it. It had this enormous Velux window in it. I mean, it was fairly ridiculous considering the size of the room, but it took up about half of one of the walls, this Velux window. And I had one of those made-to-measure blackout blind things on it, and it was incredibly efficient at keeping out light. Even in the middle of the day, you could see very little when it was shut. But there was something quite pleasing, especially on a sunny day, about pulling the blind up and watching the light flood into the room. So Isaiah is writing to a people who are about to experience what he calls the land of great darkness. Soon, one of the major world powers at the time, the Assyrian Empire, are going to conquer Israel. They're going to destroy it. They're going to take its remaining inhabitants into exile in a foreign land. Darkness has, of course, long been associated, hasn't it, with things not being how they should be. We call evil things dark, don't we? We talk about the outlook being bleak for someone whose health is failing. We talk about times of great distress as dark times. Lisa's just shared with us this morning about one such time in her own life. A lot of the book of Isaiah is caught up with warning God's people what will happen to them as a result of their turning away from God. And it's actually quite gloomy reading. But here in these verses that we've just read, we find light, we find hope. So in verse 2, we're told that the blind is going to be raised, that a great light has dawned, that the people who are walking around in the darkness of this land of deep darkness will see a great light. But before we are told what the light that brings hope is, we are told the hope that it will bring. So first in verse 3, we are told that the nation will be enlarged. War, as you know, takes lives. And when Isaiah writes, the ruthlessness of the kings at the time meant that only those who were of use to the conquering kingdom would be left alive. So Israel is going to be a depleted nation. But with the dawning of this light comes hope of a restored nation, of a thriving people. Then secondly, following on in verse 3. It will bring, it will restore joy. And Isaiah paints two pictures here that would have been very familiar to those he's writing to. The rejoicing that comes when you have a good harvest, when you know that you've got enough food for the year ahead, and the rejoicing that comes with new wealth of divided plunder after war is won. But for most of us, these ideas are probably quite foreign to us. What might be a modern-day equivalent of this sort of joy? Well, maybe if you're a sports fan, you can relate to this, particularly if say you're an English sports fan. And the joy that we're talking about here, it's like the joy at your national team, in whatever sport you want, winning a major trophy. Or if that doesn't work for you, it's like the joy that you might experience around this time of year when you get a gift that you really weren't expecting, but you really want it. The point Isaiah is making is that when this light dawns, joy will be increased. Third, with exile comes slavery. You're forced to work like animals, and that's the picture that is being painted here by Isaiah. He says that when this light dawns, the yoke, like a yoke around a horse or some oxen, it will be shattered. That the bar that goes across your back will be shattered, and the rod of oppression shattered with it. So when the light dawns, God's people will increase in number, joy will be restored, as that which confines them to darkness is destroyed. But what is this mysterious light, or who, rather, is this mysterious light? A couple of times in these early verses, Isaiah hints that this light is a person. You have, he says, enlarged the nation, verse 3, and increased its joy. And then again in verse 4, you are the one who's shattered the yoke, the bar, the rod. So this light is a person. But who? Christmas, as we know, is a time when presents are given. And some of us will have experienced the disappointment of giving someone a gift they clearly do not want. And others of us have experienced the other side of things, the awkwardness of receiving a gift that we don't want. I heard a story just this week of someone who received the Hairy Biker's diet book for Christmas. And as the present was passed to them, the gift giver exclaimed, "I saw this and thought of you." And what made that all the more awkward was, of course, that they were completely oblivious to how rude they were being. Isaiah said, when the light dawns, the nation will be enlarged, joy will be increased, oppression will end, and that this light is a person. The logical place to look for a person to do these things is for a great warrior king to rise, one who will come in might, one who will come with great military strategy, one who will come and wage a successful war against Israel's captors. But surprisingly, that's not what Isaiah says. In verse 5, he says this, "Every warrior's boot used in battle, and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire." What is he saying here? Well, the point that he's making is that when this light dawns to make the hope of Israel a reality, the well-used clothing and footwear of battle will no longer be needed. It can just be thrown in the fire. So that means these things are going to come without war. These words certainly would not have been what those who heard this prophecy were expecting. If not a military hero, then who will this person be? Over the last few weeks, Zach, our son, has discovered where the light switch is for my bedside lamp. And he takes great joy and pleasure in our reaction when he turns the light on. This is usually first thing in the morning when our eyes have not had yet time to adjust to the light. And the way that the light surprises our eyes is it's not a nice experience, is it? But the light Isaiah is talking about is surprising as well, but in a different way. It doesn't hurt our eyes. Rather, it fills us with awe and wonder. It's these verses that begin the section that we hear at this time of year in carol services around the world. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. So although this light will not be a military hero, he will be a ruler, he will govern. But notice there's a hint of something different. This child that is born is given as a gift to the people of God. That's quite a strange way to talk about a king, isn't it? And it's in the verses that follow that we see that this king is different. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Let's think about each of those in turn. He's first a Wonderful Counselor. Now, the word in the original Hebrew actually means that he is a beautiful counselor. Now, that's a very strange way to talk about a king, because kings are usually lofty and distant and detached from their subjects. But Isaiah says this king will be able to counsel beautifully. And to do that, he must understand, he must grasp what it's like to walk in darkness. Second, he is Mighty God. Now, that's an extraordinary thing to say about a king. That God can be born at all is extremely surprising, but also that this king who knows what it's like to walk in darkness is Mighty God as well. The God who created and sustains the universe, Isaiah says, will be born and walk with us in darkness. Then third, he is the Everlasting Father. And this speaks about how he draws close to those in darkness. He comes not like a king to his subjects, but with the intimacy of a father to his children, something he will do for all time. And he's also the Prince of Peace. Where other kings wage war to establish their kingdoms, this king comes to bring war to an end and to establish peace forever. Because while the other kings rise and fall, he will, verse 7, establish and uphold it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. This king is astonishing. Like his people and yet God. A king and yet a father to his people. Here to establish his kingdom through peace and not through war. As these verses being read at a carol service indicate, Christians around the world identify this king as Jesus, one who comes 600 to 700 years after this. But why? Well, I think firstly, because although Israel returns from exile, they have some semblance of kingdom again, it doesn't last very long. And we identify the king as Jesus because no one else before or after brings anything close to what Jesus does. Jesus claims to be Mighty God. Jesus knows what it's like to be a human. He knows what it's like to be born in a humble place, to never have a home of his own as an adult, to not have any money. Jesus draws close to us like a father, a child, having great compassion on those who come in contact with him. Jesus brings peace. But not between warring nations, at least not primarily. He claims to bring peace between man and God. And there are other clues in this passage too. Jesus is born in Galilee, where this king will come from. In verse 1 we read that. And this king will also be an ancestor of King David, which Jesus is. No one in history more easily identifies with this child than Jesus. But more important than that, the hope that this light dawning promises, Jesus fulfills. He has enlarged the nation. 2 billion people today around the world profess Christianity. He gives joy. Joy which is not happiness, but rather a deep satisfaction in our hearts to know him and to sense his presence even in the darkest of dark moments. This is so deeply precious that it transcends all of our circumstances. And it's trusting him that shatters the chains of the darkness that oppresses us. Now, I can say all of that to us this morning. And you could go away, you could do a bit more research into it if you liked. You could approach it with all the reason in the world and all of that sort of stuff. But I wonder if what we've heard from Lisa this morning displays quite powerfully the difference that Jesus coming to this earth can make to someone's life. Someone who is walking in a land of deep darkness. In the midst of pain and suffering, Jesus still draws close. Jesus still gives joy. Jesus can still free us from the things that enslave us. Lisa has spoken to us about the difference that God has made to her life. If he's made it in her life, why not in yours? You might not have been through something as painful as Lisa has. Maybe you even feel like life has been pretty good. But in one of the Gospels, in one of the eyewitness accounts of Jesus' life, Jesus says this. He says that he has come that we might have life and have it in all of its fullness. There's more to have. Jesus draws close. Jesus brings hope. Jesus gives joy. Jesus sets us free from the things which enslave. Just need to trust him for them. But why? Why does God do this? The very last sentence of our passage tells us, he says, the zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. It's God's passionate desire that we know him as wonderful counselor, as mighty God, as everlasting Father, as Prince of Peace. And it's because he loves us. He wants us to know him like he knows us. Not because of who we are, but in spite of it. Zach, my son, has a little book. It's called Not Too Little, which is all about how we don't need to be a particular type of person to have a relationship with Jesus. But the last sentence of that book, I think, hits the nail on the head. It says this. It says, you don't have to be a great, big, super good, important person to be God's friend. No, no, no. God is friends with you if you know you are just little and need his help. Is that you? I think that gets it. Do you need his help? You can just ask and receive it this morning. But I wonder if there's an application here for those of us who know Jesus as well. We aren't wonderful counselors in the way that Jesus is. But as we've heard, we can walk alongside those who walk in darkness, however dark it may seem. We certainly aren't mighty God, but we can point people to him. We aren't everlasting fathers, but we can meet people compassionately like Jesus did. We aren't princes of peace, but as Christians, we are called to be peacemakers, to live at peace with others as far as it depends on them. So this Christmas, who can you walk alongside? Who can you walk alongside like Jesus has come and walked with us in our darkness? Second, am I pointing other people to this mighty God by the words and actions that I say and do? Thirdly, who can I meet with fatherly compassion? And finally, are there people that I need to forgive? Are there people I need to be forgiven by? Am I preventing reconciliation with someone because of the attitude that I have? So if you don't know Jesus this morning is an opportunity to come and know him, to put your trust in him, to, as Lisa said earlier, to say yes to Jesus. We're going to pause for a moment and just reflect on what we've been thinking about. These questions will be up on the screen as well for those of us who want to use them. And after that, I think the band are going to come up and lead us in a final song to finish our service.